This, the 20th year in the life of the United Nations, is being observed throughout the world as International Cooperation Year, in the belief that greater awareness of the achievements of cooperation, rather than a preoccupation with conflict, will advance the cause of peace and human welfare. To contribute to this objective, United Nations Radio is presenting a series of special programs on the extent and nature of cooperation through international organizations. In this program, the speaker is Alexander Scorby.
I remember a bit of homespun philosophy on the subject of survival. It goes, if your neighbor's coattails catch fire, wet your own. It's colorful and direct, and perhaps at one time immensely practical, but things have changed, among them the meaning of the word neighbor. Less than half a century ago, there was still room on the earth for the remote and mystical. Today, two world wars and jet aircraft have made an end of terrestrial remoteness. India and South America, Europe and Australia are very close. Almost, you may breakfast in one place, lunch in the other, dine in the third, and wake up the following morning in the fourth. By the same token, if you're afflicted with a dangerous, highly communicable disease, say smallpox, you may, in the same span of time, carry the disease over the borders of four continents. In theory, you may. In practice, there are several reasons why this is unlikely to happen. The main reason, of course, is that nations, traditionally wary of cooperation, were eventually forced to agree to a common code of sanitary regulations to guard against the spread of disease without interfering with the newly acquired speed in trade and travel. This was, if you like, a sort of neighborliness, but it was inspired by the instinct of pure self-preservation, the need to stop, as the phrase went, the evil from abroad. It was, in fact, wetting one's own coattails. The larger concept of world health, the consideration of one's neighbor's complete physical, social, and mental well-being as the aim of all public health activity, was of more recent tentative growth. When in 1946 the World Health Organization was set up as an independent agency of the United Nations, its objective of the attainment by all peoples of the highest possible level of health through international cooperation must have seemed to many just another manifestation of post-war idealism. Take a subject like international cooperation in medical research. It seems surprising now that less than 20 years ago, Sir Julian Huxley, the eminent biologist, author, and educator, and a former director of one of the United Nations agencies, found it necessary to urge what the merest layman now takes for granted. This is what Sir Julian said.
You've got to find the right methods for getting the specialists together, making them see that there is something in the other man's point of view, making them learn to adopt some degree of common language, and once you do that, you find that if they're any good, then they can appreciate the other man's point of view, and that out of the cross-fertilization, a new organism of knowledge begins to develop.
This is a good point at which to say that the record of international cooperation in health through WHO has grown so phenomenally over the past 20 years that in this quarter of an hour's talk, there's bound to be some rapid shifting from one field of activity to another. So I've surrounded myself with a collection of tapes, discs, periodicals, documents, and so on. For instance, that recorded observation by Sir Julian on the importance of international cooperation in medical research draws my attention to something else here. It's the November 1962 issue of the magazine of the World Health Organization. On pages 12 and 13, there are two large photographs. One shows two men in a jeep silhouetted against an infinity of sky and bare rolling plateau. This is in the Middle East. The other picture shows a close-up of the jeep and the two men. They've climbed out, and they're stooping on the ground in tense, alert postures, arms and fingers spread wide, eyes intent on something so small and so well blended with its background that you tend to miss it at first sight. It's a rodent, cowering beside a wild tulip in the brown earth. They'll catch it. They must, in the interest of world health, for these men are scientists working for the World Health Organization, and that rodent, in all probability, carries the agents of the terror that used to be known as the Black Death. Here in the wild highlands, believed to be the last natural outpost of bubonic plague, international medical research is at work building up the store of common knowledge that will one day rid the world of this ancient scourge. Another page. Illustrations of WHO-sponsored investigations of current tuberculosis problems being carried out in a score of countries. Here, a report on syphilis, taming the treponeme, cultivation pursued in laboratories in Baltimore, Copenhagen, Madras, Palermo, Stockholm, Wroclaw, and London. And now I'd like you to listen to Dr. Erwin Cohn, director of the WHO Office for Research Planning and Coordination. His words explain this next photograph of a bird snared high in the treetops of the Kasanar forest in Mysore, India.
There is, for instance, some reason to believe that migrating birds are responsible for spreading certain virus diseases. It seems that infected parasites cling to the plumage of birds, which are so carried from one country to another. In order to substantiate this hypothesis, these ectoparasites of the birds have to be collected and investigated along their entire course of migration for what are called arthropod-borne viruses. This entails the cooperation of governments, research institutions, and investigators in different countries. And the World Health Organization is the most, or even only, suited organization to assume the leadership role and give assistance to the advancement of such studies.
You'll remember, I'm sure, occasions in the not-too-distant past when the administration of new vaccines or antibiotics had to be suspended because defects in the substances had been discovered. One needs to be reassured that a course of treatment with antibiotics begun in one country can be safely continued with antibiotics prepared in another country. In other words, one needs international standards. The adoption of these standards and the distribution of standardized samples are undertaken by WHO, a task inherited from the League of Nations. The next words seem to leap from the page. Cancer research. Agonizing questions and appalling facts almost stare us out of countenance. We know that cancer exists all over the world and that there is no area with a cancer-free population. This bald statement should alone be sufficient to illustrate the need for international cooperation in research. But I would like you to listen once again to Dr. Cohn, who has something to add.
There is, for instance, undoubtedly, an important clue to the solution of the cancer problem hidden in the fact that certain types of cancer are very common in certain populations, whereas they are rare in others. There is a reason for these peculiarities, and when investigators from various countries will be able to explore these problems on the spot, compare findings with those made in other areas by other research workers and in other laboratories, we might be able to put the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together, which will yield the full picture of our understanding of what cancer is and how to conquer it.
Does all this sound like an extension of the idea of wetting one's own coattails? Isn't cancer, after all, a common enemy? Very well, so it is. So is every important disease in the world. Take malaria. Here, international cooperation has made possible a very significant shift in objectives. In the international health meetings of the early 1950s, control of malaria began to give way to something bolder, so that by 1960, Dr. Burford Weeks, chief of programs in the WHO Division of Malaria, could make this report.
The situation today bears testimony to the serious attention that the nations of the world have paid to this problem and to the historic resolution they passed just over 4 years ago at the 8th World Health Assembly, setting the worldwide eradication of malaria as the ultimate goal.
Eradicate. Root out. There's a suggestion of fury in the word. The vocabulary of the eradication campaign launched against malaria in 1955 through WHO is full of furious, aggressive language. Reconnaissance, attack, consolidation, surveillance. The campaign against malaria goes on, internationally. Would there were time to do more than note in passing how international cooperation is organized against blindness, heart disease, drug addiction, mental illness. There is more, much more to the story than the bare quoting of figures to show how the pitiful world shortage of doctors is engaging the attention, energies, and resources of nations acting together. There is more to the question of world health than the absence of disease. There is, in the words of the Constitution of the World Health Organization, the attainment by all peoples of the highest possible level of health. Constantly changing objectives are a concomitant of socio-economic evolution. Yesterday's villager is today's urban dweller. Industrialization, technical progress bring their special environmental and psychological problems. The highest possible level of health remains the complete physical, social, and mental well-being of the individual. But individuals themselves need to adapt themselves to the ever-increasing tempo of technical and social change. International cooperation for the world's health has had to move along an ever-widening front with each step since the establishment of EPID Nations, the code name for the Worldwide Intelligence Service for the Detection of Epidemics. Medical science has created more old people. They must be cared for. The growing number of handicapped persons rescued from death or worse by science, they must be rehabilitated. The special problems of juvenile delinquency cry out for investigation. The purity of the world's waters, the freshness of the world's air, these are the new objectives. The peaceful uses of atomic energy, this is the new world preoccupation. And hovering just a little above our heads is the impending question of health in space. To conclude, let me just play you what was said by a man who was the president of the 12th World Health Assembly, the annual meeting of health specialists from over 100 nations, itself an important element in international cooperation. The speaker is Sir John Charles.
International collaboration in the health field, which has existed now since the days of the Health Committee of the League of Nations, in other words, nearly for 40 years, has been intensified since 1946. And if one looks back over the record of WHO, WHO has not been perhaps primarily responsible for the great improvement in the health of the world that's taken place.
I'm interrupting Sir John here only to underline the truth of his last statement. Much is owed to regional organizations, to the numerous units of national and private effort, to the great independent research institutions of the world. The World Health Organization does not, cannot replace them. But let Sir John Charles continue.
WHO has not been perhaps primarily responsible for the great improvement in the health of the world that's taken place. But it has acted as a catalyzer. It has acted as the channel through which human beings, scientists have communicated with one another. It has inspired, it has stimulated.
Above all, it has shown that it is not enough to wet one's own coattails. That in fact, yours and your neighbor's coattails are one and the same.
You've just heard Alexander Scorby in one of a series of special programs from UN Radio produced for 1965, International Cooperation Year.